Welcome to The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, October 2nd, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll hear from Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford and Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. We'll talk to George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Mike Dean up at the State House. Let's start off with CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. Good morning to you both.
Morning, Steve.
Jeanette, the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force this week came out with some information about how the region fared this summer with business and tourism. It wasn't as bad as some feared. Is that the short version here?
Yes. Well, they certainly know that some businesses are still hurting, but the task force is looking at some healthy trends. So they look at a few different metrics of tourism. One pretty simple one is bridge traffic. We're familiar with that. Bridge traffic started the spring down 25% compared to last year, but over the course of the summer, it really improved a fair amount. So by August, the average weekend was off only 10%. And then for the Labor Day weekend, when it really seemed like people wanted to come to the Cape, the bridge traffic was actually 2% higher than last year. They also look at overnight occupancy in accommodations. So there, the house rentals did better than hotels. Hotel stays were down 15% for the season, but rentals were down just 4%. Some people actually took their homes off the market during the pandemic, they said. Another trend this year was actually longer stays. So they said it was quite a bit more common for renters this year to opt for a longer stay of like 30 or 60 days, and in some cases even 90 days.
Rental prices were up too, right?
Yes, yes. Prices were up 5%, and I was asking what's going to happen to renters who can't afford to stay 30 or 60 days or pay higher prices, but it looks like right now in this market, that's just the prices that they're going to be commanding.
Now, the task force is also watching closely the COVID numbers for the region, and they've been seeing them trending upward, yes?
Yes, they're elevated slightly from some of the lull periods that we had over the summer. So late July was not great for COVID. We're still lower than that, but we did have some really low case counts on the Cape in June and especially in mid-August. There were periods when the Cape was seeing just one or two new cases a day and sometimes no cases on a given day. Now it's back up in the range of 7 to 9, which is much lower, of course, than in the spring when the transmission really was not well controlled and we were hitting numbers in the 30s regularly. So still lower than that, but up a little from the quiet point.
And hospitalizations, they're watching those numbers as well.
Yes, they are watching the hospitalizations. There was a period, again, kind of in the summer, where the average daily inpatient.
That 3-day average.
COVID. The 3-day average, yes. They take that over a 3-day period. For a while, it was zero. The average was zero for a few weeks. And Vera Harik from the County Department of Human Services says those numbers are up slightly too. I believe it might have been 8 for a 3-day average. I don't have that figure right in front of me, but yeah.
Eve Zuckoff, the Army National Guard's proposal to put a machine gun range at Joint Base Cape Cod was back in the news this week. First, the state came out with some strong reservations. Tell us, what did we hear?
Yeah, so a state environmental official said he actually dug into some of the National Guard's environmental reports, and he found some concerning inconsistencies, is how he describes them. He says, you know, the Guard is calling for the use of weapons actually that rely on lead ammunition rather than copper ammunition. And this is a really big concern because the base sits on top of kind of a massive drinking water supply that serves the entire Upper Cape. And lead contamination of drinking water, you know, that that's a really big concern. So the which is why the state and the guard agreed in the first place to use copper ammunition. There's also a grenade launcher that the guard calls for, and the ammunition of that consists of 99% RDX, that's a known groundwater contaminant. And the state and federal agencies have already spent a combined $1.2 billion over the last 20 years cleaning up these contaminants because it really got to a point where it was that bad. So there's a community trust issue here, really, that's at stake. And what's really interesting to me about this update in this story is that the letter came from the head of the Environmental Management Commission, the state commission that oversees the protection of the drinking water supply and wildlife habitat around the base. And the EMC has to approve the project before any construction can begin. So for a letter to come from them, that's significant. That's signaling that they're really not happy with what the Army National Guard is up to right now.
Now, all along, there's been a sense with this that the process hasn't been terribly public or transparent. One of the things that seemed lacking was a public meeting, but now the Army National Guard has scheduled one, or is that actually the state that's scheduled one?
Yeah, it's not exactly the Army National Guard. So it's the Environmental Management Committee, along with two advisory groups made up of citizens and scientists. They called for the meeting, but you are right that there will be some representatives from the Guard that we're expecting to hear from during this meeting. This will be the first time the public has a chance to do that. They were allowed to send public comments in until September 8th, but this is the first chance for a meeting. That's set for next Thursday, October 8th at 5:30. We have the details on how to access the Zoom meeting on our website, capeandislands.org.
Jeanette, we're into October now. That means the census was supposed to have ended this past week on Wednesday, but it didn't. Tell us what happened here.
Right. So the Trump administration wanted to end the census on September 30th, Wednesday, but that was a month earlier than the original extension that had been created because of the pandemic. So many people were warning that they really wouldn't be able to get an accurate count by the end of September. It went to court. A federal judge ruled last Thursday that the October date was going to stand. Everyone at the time, we expected the administration would appeal, and they did. And then in the interim, the Census Bureau announced it was stopping the count October 5th. And then the most recent action I've seen is 2 days ago, the appeal was denied in the federal court. So as it stands now, the census should continue through the end of October based on the original court ruling.
What a way to run a census. Also, in your reporting on this, you did some digging on how the census numbers may or may not be reconciled against other data the state already has about population. Tell us about this.
Yeah, a few people had asked me, so what happens if the various local records that are available show there are people living here who didn't fill out the census? Is there any way to reconcile those two things? I talked to the Secretary of State's office, and they told me they have been asking the Census Bureau to supplement the census for a while with some kinds of administrative records, such as the state voter database or residence listings. But they say they haven't gotten anywhere with the Census Bureau in that request.
Eve, a story you covered this week, a lot of commercial fishermen were paying close attention as a fishing regulatory board met to discuss the future of fishing monitors that are placed on many fishing boats. This week, the board voted in favor of a new plan that aspires to 100% monitoring of fishing boats. Tell us a little bit about this discussion.
Yeah, Jeanette and I are both covering stories about counting this week, it seems. So the plan calls for in-person observers or video monitoring on up to 100% of trips, as you say, made by fishermen who target cod, flounder, haddock, ground fish, what we're talking about there. But the real question, of course, is about cost. Who pays for 100% of monitoring, which gets really expensive? It can be up to $700 a day. For the last few years, the government and other agencies, or actually private organizations, have been covering the costs, but fishermen want to know, if you're increasing from 40% of trips monitored to 100% of trips, are we stuck with the bill? Well, for the first 4 years, nearly all costs are expected to be covered by the federal government and other organizations to avoid financially overburdening fishermen. But if the costs aren't fully covered beyond that point, the monitoring level could drop back to the current 40% level that would be paid for in part by fishermen. And then that's for the first 4 years. The fifth year, there would be new considerations. It, as you said, is really controversial. This has been controversial for years, but during the meeting we did hear fishermen say, I support that 100% as long as for the whole period of time you got up there, you don't have to pay for that. I think there was a sigh of relief that costs are not being shifted over to fishermen in this plan.
Why aim for 100% monitoring if they've been doing 40% monitoring or aiming for 40% for all this time? Why step it up now?
Well, so the point is to better inform scientists and stock managers about what's being caught in our local waters, because they're trying to get a better and more accurate quota to prevent some fishermen from overfishing, misreporting, and illegal discarding. This is, you know, in part to bring back the codfish, which is its recovery plan has a 0 to 1% chance of working on schedule right now. And so that's really the goal here. And then looking forward, I was told by one expert, the fishery actually needs this. Fishermen need this. Climate change is changing the distribution of fish we have here. And if we don't have good numbers, good, accurate numbers of what fish are here so we can set the right quotas for the years to come, we're not serving anybody. We're not helping anybody. And so that's really the consideration when we talk about making this very big change to this industry.
CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome, Steve.
On Martha's Vineyard, efforts are underway to establish homeless shelters ahead of the coming winter. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette joins us with the story. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, tell us, what does the homeless problem look like on the island, and what's the need here that they're looking to fill?
Well, the need, I think, for a lot of people might be somewhat surprising, but there are, according to Karen Tui, who worked as a homelessness prevention coordinator for Dukes County previously, there are over 100 people, at least, who are in some homeless, as in, you know, it can mean a variety of different things, but basically living out of their car, living in a campsite, don't have secure housing, and that's what they call pretty much critically homeless. And I think for a lot of people, that number is somewhat surprising considering it's Martha's Vineyard. But there is a significant need here. And at least 15 to 20 of those people regularly use what, at least in previous years, has been a winter shelter. And the winter shelter is run by the church, by some churches on the island. But this year, of course, they had to close the winter shelter early last year because of the pandemic. And then this year, they're not going to be able to open again, at least at the churches. So there's sort of a gap, and island organizations are trying to figure out what to do to fill it.
Well, tell us about some of the initiative here to try to fill that gap. The Martha's Vineyard Hospital has stepped forward?
Yes. So the hospital, and this was announced at a food equity meeting yesterday, and the hospital put out a more formal announcement later in the day, but they're pledging $150,000 basically as a grant that the county is going to be the fiscal agent for, and that's going to pretty much go to aiding shelter for the homeless. And what that means is that it's going to be money for staffing. That was one of the issues when they had to close the homeless shelters last spring, was that a lot of the people staffing them are all volunteers, and many of them would be in a high-risk category for COVID. And so the hospital's money is going to go to paying trained staff. It's going to go to basically providing necessary services with the pandemic. It's going to go to things like providing PPE and other sort of equipment that's going to be necessary to keep any sort of shelter space that does end up getting found safe. And that's kind of one of the issues right now, is trying to find the proper shelter. And what it looks like is going to happen is that there's going to have to be more than one, because there's probably not a space on the island that's large enough to house, you know, 15 people for a night, especially considering airflow and that kind of issue with COVID.
Do they feel like they have enough with this grant from the hospital, or are they still actively looking to raise more money to put this together?
Well, I think the the money issue is one that, you know, they're always looking for more money to help, definitely. But I think that if they were able to find a space or multiple spaces, then the program would be able to move forward. And from the beginning, that's sort of been the broader issue, is that, hey, we have sort of the resources and the community activism around the issue, but there isn't necessarily anyone stepping forward for a space. And I think that is the problem that they're trying to solve right now. And there have been some ideas floated about using potentially firehouses, you know, other sort of big spaces on the island, but they're all complicated by certain things. And one of the other issues is that hotels have been brought forward as an option, and that is an option for some members of the homeless community, but it isn't an option for other members of the homeless community, which makes it complicated figuring out a place where the most critically homeless are able to be housed. And there's a large number of them. Actually, just yesterday, the Edgartown Police put out a missing persons request for someone. His name was Daniel Antonio Rodriguez, and he was living in a tent by the Carolyn Tuck Hill Preserve, and he hasn't been seen since August. So this really is an issue here, and as winter's coming, these groups are trying to work together to solve it, despite all the challenges that there are with COVID.
It's Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
A special town meeting scheduled for tomorrow morning in Chatham has been put off at the last minute or so. This is over an issue that's had a lot of people in town talking. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle has this story. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, the town meeting was to vote on a proposal to redevelop the Monomoy Theater property. What's the controversy here, and why this sudden postponement or cancellation or whatever this is, deferment?
Well, to be clear, the meeting will be happening at 1 o'clock tomorrow at Veterans Field. Because it was called by petition, the town has no choice but to go forward with the meeting. Now, the issue is the single article that is on the warrant, which was filed by the petitioner, which is the owner of the Monomoy Theater in town, Alexandra Properties, which is owned by Greg Clark, who's a summer resident here. Now, Mr. Clark had filed a zoning change to institute an overlay district on the Monomoy Theater property, which would essentially allow the redevelopment of the land with additional allowances that would not usually be allowed on the property, specifically multifamily housing, or what he's proposing are 24 luxury condominiums, which he said would help finance the restoration of the theater building and a historic house on the property. The controversy came earlier this week when there was a public hearing on the zoning amendment with the planning board. And the planning board and a number of members of the public objected to the proposal, which they saw as overly allowing too much to be given away without any assurances specifics that the theater would be renovated or specifically reopened to the public. The Board of Selectmen also voted to oppose the article, as did the Finance Committee. What happened, I believe, is that Mr. Clark realized that it was unlikely that the article would get the two-thirds majority it requires at the town meeting. So what he's asking instead is to basically defer action on the article and refer it back to the planning board for further discussions. There was, at Monday's hearing, there was a little bit of discussion about how they could make the article work, and the planning board was willing to work with Mr. Clark, but because the meeting is coming up Saturday, there wasn't enough time to revise the language in that article. So essentially, what they're going to request Saturday is that any action on the article is postponed, and that it be revised and probably revisited in the spring. Now, the interesting thing is that you know, it's a town meeting, so anyone can make a motion on that article. And if that particular proposal is defeated, the article could come up for a positive vote or a negative vote. It's going to be kind of interesting to see how that procedurally is handled. It'll determine kind of the fate of this article. And as we've talked about in the past, Steve, the Monomoy Theater is, you know, it's been around for over 70 years. It's a much loved institution in town. It was run as a summer teaching theater by first Ohio University and most recently the University of Hartford. It was it closed down 2 years ago after there were some violations of health codes and other things that were found there by the town. And the previous owner of the theater, instead of doing upgrades, decided to sell it. And Mr. Clark was the buyer of that property. But he's assured the town that his ultimate plan is to reopen the theater. He said it's not going to be like it was in the past. It can't be that way. He said it just doesn't, it can't function that way. There's no, just the logistics aren't going to work. But he said he has talked to organizations about running a summer theater there. And he said he needs to build a housing on the property in order to make the theater debt free so that it can be used in the summer. And also he said he'd offer local schools and nonprofit organizations to use it at no charge in the off season. So there's a desire in town to bring this back, but also some concern over the density of that housing.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle with the story. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Provincetown schools are planning to reopen for some in-person schooling this coming Monday. They've got some particular issues to navigate to make that happen. Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner joins us with this. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Marianne, tell us, what sets Provincetown's public school system apart in its effort to get going?
Well, let's see. It is a small school system, so it's 150 students. And some of the issues or some of the things that are particularly unique is that, and the town itself being, it's a small town, but it really gets packed with tourists and visitors. So particularly as the school began to consider opening, just basically opening for the semester, school officials were worried that the students' families who work in the tourism industry might be at risk for COVID-19, and then that could spread to the students. So the first kind of hurdle for the school was to remain remote-only learning for the first, I think it's 2 to 3 weeks of the semester. And fortunately, the town of Provincetown has had close to zero number of COVID cases, COVID-19 cases, really in the last several weeks. So that factor in and of itself has allowed the school to go to what they're calling a hybrid model. So partially, students would be partially in school and then learn partially at home.
So one of the things that you point to in your article is that the school has only one school bus, which logistically makes things tricky.
I know. So I guess normally school buses can take about 70 students, but right now it's limited to, due to COVID-19, I believe it's limited to 22 students. So they're having to do some kind of interesting logistical management of taking kids home, bringing them to school, just to kind of manage that. And the bus problem, I guess there's an ongoing shortage of buses and bus drivers, not just related to COVID-19. So kind of that factor, the superintendent, Suzanne Scallion, says she is looking for both buses and bus drivers. So yeah, it's a problem for them.
Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner, thank you for joining us this morning.
Okie doke, thank you.
Through much of the spring and early summer, Nantucket seemed to mostly escape the coronavirus, but in the last few weeks, numbers have spiked on the islands. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer Mirror is on the line now. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, it sounds like these surging numbers are being traced back, for the most part, to a couple of particular events. Tell us what we know here.
Well, the most recent information we have is from yesterday, when 4 new cases of COVID-19 were reported on the island. That increases to 38, the total number of positive tests in the last week. there have been 92 confirmed coronavirus cases on Nantucket in the last 22 days. And those begin with, as you said, the island's first real spike, September 9th, that was linked to workers in the trades. 144 people on Nantucket have tested positive since mid-March when testing began. Now, the town's health director, Roberto Santa Maria, said Sunday night that the majority of the most recent cases, and he confirmed this later as well, including some of the more recent ones, are linked to a single church gathering at which a communal meal was shared. He wouldn't say what church that was. But did say that contact tracing has been done and is underway on that. A smaller cluster of positive cases on Wednesday appears tied to a private in-home daycare service, he said. And a worker at the Mid Island Stop and Shop also tested positive over the weekend. The store didn't close any of its usual hours, but it was deep cleaned during its overnight and regular closure. The school superintendent on Tuesday also announced that the state has ordered remote learning for most students to continue through at least October 19th. Most students were supposed to go back for a hybrid learning plan twice a week, starting yesterday on the 1st. And town businesses and restaurants can't take advantage of the latest easing of restrictions under the governor's reopening plan until Nantucket's out of the red zone, which will probably be at least another couple of weeks. Of those 20 new cases over the weekend as well, one was an employee of Nantucket Cottage Hospital, but hospital officials don't believe that staff member contracted the virus while at work. And no one else so far that had any exposure to them has tested positive, they said. No coronavirus positive patients are hospitalized on Nantucket currently, but three in the past week have been transferred off island for a higher level of care.
I don't want to switch gears too quickly here, but on a more upbeat note, I want to mention it's family scallop season. Tell us, what does that mean for folks on the island?
It's a good way to get outside and escape some of the coronavirus concerns in a social distance way. Recreational scalloping season gets underway each year on October 1st. That was yesterday. And Nantucketers and visitors alike were headed out to Nantucket Harbor and Matticat Harbor with push rakes and baskets so they could get some of the famous Nantucket Bay scallops for the dinner table or the freezer. Recreational season runs Wednesday through Sunday through October 31st, and commercial season begins on November 1st when they'll start showing up in the island's fish markets again. We put a little piece together for our website with some advice and tips from the harbor master and the town's natural resources director about safety advice and other rules that you need to follow if you're going to go out there for recreational scallops this year.
It's one of the great moments of the season. Josh Bowling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This next story comes with a bit of a warning. You may get hungry listening to us talk about it. Jack Spillane from the Standard Times in New Bedford is on the line. Hi, Jack.
Hi, how are you today?
Jack, this is about a family business restaurant expanding to a new location, but it's really about more than that. It's about what it takes to start and maintain and grow a small business, and especially in this challenging pandemic time. Tell us about this family behind the restaurant and the restaurant itself.
Well, this is a family that came with virtually nothing to New Bedford, Iris De La Rosa, and they really, you know, had just nothing, and they started this very almost like a just a hole in the wall burrito shop, and they did okay for a while, but then, you know, they really needed to expand, so they had indoor seating, and they didn't know how to do it. And we have a couple of groups in New Bedford that the Community Economic Development Center that helps people get loans. And there is a tradition in Latin America of everyone in the neighborhood contributing to a fund that can then be used for people who want to start small businesses or expand small businesses, depending on the value of the project. And that's how they did it, and they recently moved to a much bigger restaurant that has seating and all in the same North End neighborhood that has become a very ethnic Central American Caribbean neighborhood in the North End of New Bedford. And Taqueria La Raza has really become a great success.
And the article is really brings us into the kitchen and into the sort of the heart and spirit of the place in terms of how this business, like you say, got going with a lot of neighborhood support, but also maintains itself. It's so much part of the fabric of the community, it sounds like.
It's very much an extended family business, as many immigrant businesses are. The place where people come and sit, and or people work part time or full time. It really is a home away from home. It's just a very interesting approach, I think, to growing a business. That north end, the near north end of New Bedford, Acushnet Avenue, is just replete with these small businesses, many of which, of course, have suffered with the pandemic. But it's very different than sort of American storefronts, and even the way they financed it is different. I found it actually quite inspiring.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Community Economic Development Center, which was also involved in helping support this restaurant as they sought to expand?
Yeah, so the Community Economic Development Center, which is run by Corinne Williams and Ken Raposa, has been in the city for many years now, and their mission is to help low-income communities start businesses and to realize the American dream, I guess you would say. And they do a lot of stuff with identifying locations and ways of low-interest financing. They've been quite successful in their business. But the interesting part to me was the Community Economic Development Center using this Sociedad. The Sociedad is the it is a tradition in Latin American countries where people will contribute to a fund voluntarily, and that fund, then the group decides which business they're going to lend the money to expand their business. So it's a very interesting concept.
And is Jack Spillane joining us from the Standard Times in New Bedford. Jack, thanks.
Thanks very much.
Plymouth and Brockton bus line was approved for a big loan from the federal government to help carry it through the pandemic. So far, it seems not to have spent any of that money. Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times has this story and joins us now. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Ethan, the company hasn't spent that money, but is it running any buses?
No. PMB stopped running in March and hasn't run anything since.
And for folks who maybe don't even know this, the PNB, the Plymouth and Brockton Street Railway Company, is the real name, but they're the bus line. They made, before the pandemic, they were like the leading bus line between the Cape and Boston.
Yeah, they're the most robust. I mean, if you get off a plane at Logan at 10 o'clock, they're your option. Peter Pan has come into the scene over the past couple of years, but PMB still has the most robust service between the Cape, the South Shore, and up to Boston.
So tell us about this loan that they were able to access and what it means for what their kind of strategy is with taking this loan but not trying to keep their buses running with it.
Yeah, so the issue that seemed to miss some riders was the whole idea. So they got between a $1 and $2 million loan from the Small Business Administration. They're called the PPP loans, Paycheck Protection Program loans. And so the idea behind those is businesses got these loans very early on in the pandemic. And the idea was to keep your employees employed, keep business going when there may not be that demand. And public transportation, mass transportation, obviously, there was not a whole lot of appetite for that very early on, and it still doesn't seem like there's much even now. But so PMB, they got this loan. They haven't spent any of it. So a lot of people were angry, saying this was kind of the idea was it was supposed to bring your employees back to work. PMB is seeing it as a way to kind of preserve jobs in the future instead of paying their employees now. I even talked to the union rep for the mechanics and the drivers, and he saw it as if we brought them back when we got this loan, we would have burned through the money, and then we would have just had to lay everybody off again. So right now they're collecting unemployment. For a while they were collecting that extra $600 that was given kind of as an extra aid. And so this money will kind of help once we get back running, which there still isn't a total timeline yet. But that's their kind of thought. One thing to note, through the PPP program, if you did get this money and you used it mostly to pay workers, to put people to work, that loan was forgiven by the federal government. So they're expecting actually that they will have to repay this loan eventually down the line.
The other, you mentioned the Peter Pan bus line. They are running right now. Is that right?
Peter Pan is running. Some of the RTAs are also running, regional transit authorities, which actually this union that represents the PMB drivers also represents them. And PMB was the only line that wasn't running. From what I've heard, Peter Pan is not extremely busy, which, again, there's not really – one of the big things for these buses is a lot of people either commute to Boston on these buses or go to the airport or kind of take a day trip to the city without taking their cars. And none of those activities, working in the city, getting on planes, or just taking day trips to crowded places seem to be a huge draw for Cape Codders at the moment.
Any word from PMB about when they're planning to start back up again?
They have no schedule at the moment. They're kind of saying we're working on it, but again, the economics for them, they don't see that it's there. So they are not, no plans as of yet.
It's Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times with the story. Ethan, thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve.
An Oak Bluffs man recently had his home shot at by a BB gun and a sign vandalized. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times is here to tell us about it. Hi, George.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
George, this is David Morris. What happened here? Tell us.
Yeah, so this is David Morris's house in Oak Bluffs. And, you know, he had signs of a BB that shot through a window. He actually found the pellet inside, showed it to our reporter in a little baggie that he found. But also he had a Trump Pence flag that he had sort of erected to the side of his house, up pretty high on the house. So not as if someone could, you know, just going by do this. And the photo shows that it's shredded in the middle. Some projectile went through that sign. So, you know, he's upset about that, but he's undeterred. He's saying that, you know, I ought to be able to support whoever I want and, you know, not have someone come by and vandalize his house and his personal property. And, you know, he did report it to the police, and they're looking into it. You know, it actually was a police officer on a detail that he was chatting with who pointed this out to him, that the sign was that there was a hole in his sign up on the side of his house. He hadn't noticed that previously, you know, and he has family living with him in the house. And, you know, someone obviously could have gotten hurt with that, you know, BB pellet going through a window like that.
And the implication here is that the BB pellet is also related to the sign, that the sign was provoking to somebody who responded that way by vandalizing the house.
Yeah, so he doesn't know for sure. Nobody left a note or anything saying, you know, this is because of your support of Trump. But we all know that this is one of the most politicized elections in our history. People are very, very divided on the candidates. And, you know, there have been incidents all across the country on both sides, people taking signs, vandalizing signs, and, you know, just treating people with disrespect because of who they support. So I can't say it's a surprise to see that there is some something like this on the island, because it's been happening virtually everywhere.
I want to ask you about another story. We've been hearing plenty about the wildfires in California. It touched close to home for Islanders this week with the news that the brother of a well-known local musician lost his home to the fire, or to one of the fires. This is an affecting story. I thought this was very moving. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is Wallace J. Nichols. He's the brother of island musician Johnny Hoy, and lots of people know Johnny. And I got to talk to Mr. Nichols. He goes by Jay, by the way. And, you know, he just talked to us about, you know, what it was like to go and see this house that was a home. This was
a beautiful
19
home.
Years. It was a beautiful home, and it was where his two children were raised. His daughter was actually, his wife was pregnant with the daughter when the house was first built. So she lived there her entire life to that point. She had just left for college the day before. And, you know, Jay said that this is sort of a blessing because she would have wanted to stay and she needs to be at college and, you know, would have been, it was devastating to her, but, you know, would have kept her from going off to her freshman year, which he sent this really, really moving letter to her. I quote from it in the piece, you know, just heartfelt from a dad about, you know, how bad he felt that he couldn't save the family home. And, you know, he talks about, you know, wanting to stay there and thinking about, well, I have these water tanks, I have fire extinguisher, I have a fire hat, and it's a good thing
to stay there and try to protect it as the fire was coming. Right. Yes.
Right. And it's a good thing he didn't. He listened to his neighbors and he took what he could. He and his daughter left. Obviously a picture's worth a thousand words, right? You can see the decimation in the photo that he shared with us, just a chimney standing at the site. And, just, you know, and what I, in the conversation that we had, I said to him, you know, thank you for sharing this story because we hear about the thousands upon thousands of acres and we hear about people's homes being devastated, but it doesn't really come to life until someone tells their story. And this was a very powerful story. And, you know, his brother is just devastated for him. Did speak to Johnny Hoy about it. And he said it's just heartbreaking to see his brother's home that he put his heart and soul in to gone.
It's George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Take care.
Governor Baker is allowing Massachusetts cities and towns with low levels of coronavirus transmission to ease some restrictions on businesses and gatherings. Meanwhile, advocates are becoming impatient with state lawmakers over a stalled police reform bill. Earlier, I talked with CAI State House reporter Mike Dean about these stories. Here's our conversation. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how are you?
Mike, let's start with the governor's announcement that some cities and towns can progress to part two of the third phase of the reopening plan. What does that mean?
Well, indoor and outdoor performance and event venues, you know, places that, you know, a lot of towns have, especially down on Cape Cod, they can expand their capacity to 250 people or 50% without going over that 250. So that means that it's only in towns with fewer than 8 COVID cases per 100,000 people. That's the tricky bit here. It's that map the state has been pushing for school reopenings especially, but that gives kind of the status level of each municipality. It's for the gray and green towns. Anybody with a higher risk is not going to be allowed to take this next step. But there are other things in here. There's, you know, laser tag facilities, indoor skating rinks, things like that. Retail fitting rooms is one thing that a lot of people might have access to. So the increased capacity, though, also applies to a number of things that had already been reopened. So museums, libraries, gyms can now bump themselves up from what was mostly a 25% capacity to now 50%.
It's understandable that some business owners are happy about this, but not everyone thinks it's a good idea. A group of healthcare workers wrote to the governor hours before this announcement this week, concerned about a slow rise in COVID-19 cases.
Yeah, that was right before Baker made the announcement, actually, and so they really do contrast each other. It's a letter signed by dozens of medical experts, elected officials, local officials, folks like that, and they're calling on Baker to put stronger restrictions in place, saying that he didn't go far enough, didn't bend the curve enough, or flatten the curve enough, and that's why these numbers are creeping up, and so they want more of a lockdown method, more of a kind of centralized strategy for these lockdowns and restrictions going into the fall, going into the colder weather, when everyone does anticipate that we have another, you know, spike in cases here. And they said they especially need to focus in those red areas where, you know, the virus has kind of done the worst damage. But to his credit, Baker already has this Stop the Spread program that's free testing in those communities that are already hardest hit. And if you take a look at that map, that really is some of the areas and cities around Boston and some other hot spots here and there. I think there are 18 or 20 communities right now that they're really focusing a lot of resources in.
Let's turn to police reform. Advocates for police reform were out in person and virtually this week trying to push state lawmakers to move on a proposal that's been sitting in limbo for about 2 months. Do you think these efforts will inspire lawmakers to take up the bill?
You know, it could, but there's very little political downside for Democrats here since they've already won all of those primaries. You know, challenges from Republicans and Democrats that do have incentive to kind of run towards the middle and toward that more police-friendly position and not necessarily towards the position on the left of, you know, protesters and some of these advocates here. So this bill has kind of just been stuck up in this political limbo, so to speak, and it's important to remember what it would do overall, and these are the parts that most everyone agrees on. It would certify police and allow decertification if the officer violates new standards of behavior that are going to be put into place, and it offers new training for police to get up to that standard. And these are going to be statewide for the first time, not the patchwork of different city and town regulations and standards that we have now. The sticking point, though, between the House and the Senate negotiators is that qualified immunity, that's protections that police have against civil lawsuits. So with a lot of pressure being put on all the members of the legislature on this one, it is, you know, seems like it's going to be locked up for a little while because, you know, Massachusetts legislature is just a heck of a lot more moderate and does not want to go the fully progressive way that the Senate has been on this one. That means a deadlock.
It's been a different kind of year for Beacon Hill, too. When they voted to extend their session at the end of the year this year, it really seemed to take the steam out of a lot of the momentum behind this legislation.
Yeah, exactly. They instead of extending it and doing a kind of overtime scenario, they kind of used this deadline extension to shift into how they do business on a normal non-election year. So a lot of people are waiting with bated breath to see what they do. Much of this hangs on the fiscal situation the state's going through right now. Because there is no budget, a lot of these bills just can't get done. Those negotiations have stalled because anything with a price tag is up in the air. So without resolution to the budget, which lawmakers say will come in October, I don't think we're going to see too much action on anything until November.
That's CAI State House reporter Mike Dean. Mike, thanks for talking with us.
Great to be with you.
And that is our local news roundup. I'm Steve Junker. I want to thank my guests that we heard from, CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle and Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. Heard from Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford. We checked in with Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Mike Dean there up at the State House. As ever, big thanks to Dan Treidle back at the studio. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.